Do you were a council member during what years?
From 1980 to 84, and and I spent a lot of time as a city council member dealing with police brutality as well. But I used to have my own hearings in City Hall, you know, and the city, you know, the police department's right in the basement underneath City Hall, and they would have to listen to people as they came in and complain, and then for me. Using that, you know, to do as much as possible to get rid of police, and we got rid of a number of police officers during that time. You know, my biggest concern at the time was that while we had gotten rid of them in Seaside, you know, there were officers that I was, as a city council member, pressing to get prosecuted, and they never did. And then they left, and I'm sure that they left and went to other communities and got hired on there. You know, so that was always a big concern, and while. Many people saw that as a victory, you know, that we were actually able to get rid of cops.
Yeah, we have the same situation. Of course, that's true in all police departments, but here in Santa Cruz, Officer David LaFavor, who in a rare situation was found guilty of excessive force by an independent review, the only independent review we've ever had in Santa Cruz, taken under the kind of the auspices of the Citizens Police Rubber Stamping Board, as I call it, the but they were there was sufficient political outcry, and the city council members were sufficiently new when this came. The case came up. It involved an officer who was putting a pain compliance hold at a woman holding a child in the middle of a protest, threatening, in essence, the woman for the safety of the child. And this guy came up and slugged the police officer.
Yeah, that was Steve, right?
That was Steve Argue, right? Who served seven or eight, well, he was sentenced to 9 months. I think he served 7 months in jail here for that. But LaFavor was let go by the police department. And, of course, I think he went up and zip, as you point out. Rumor has it he's joined an East Bay police force.
Yeah.
Where no one knows what he's doing now. So you, as a council member, were effective as an individual in getting some police officers, some attention on police officers, some review process, kind of your own established review process while you were a council member.
Right, and that's because I think part of the reason why I was elected to office was because of stands that I had taken over the years against police brutality and certainly against this particular police department here. So when I, you know, so actually there was a lot of support for that, you know, from the community, because obviously I, as one person, would not have been able to affect anything. But the fact that those ideas, you know, were the ideas that I was elected on, and then I tried to carry those ideas out once I was elected.
That was 20 years ago, and did anyone pick up on that after you had left, or
no,
were you?
No. No. But the other point that I wanted to make, too, you know, before we close out, is that one of the reasons why I think people are really supportive of this kind of ad hoc, whatever you want to call it, and we have yet to really give it a true name, but I think we're calling it the People's Tribunal. But the reason why people are banding together with us on this is because they saw that we were actually able to accomplish some things with the Charles Vaughn Task Force. We weren't able to prosecute the cops, and for me, that's heartrending, and we're still trying to do that. But we were able to get the Crisis Intervention Team Academy. We were able to get all of the police departments in Monterey County now that never had any kind of protocols or rules or procedures for dealing with people, specifically dealing with people with mental illness. All of them now have those kinds of procedures and protocols. And so that's a result of the work of the Charles Vaughn Task Force. And so I think that, you know, when people see that, then people see that actually things can be done. You know, we have forced POST, you know, the Police Officers Standards and Training Organization in Sacramento to begin implementing a real mental health curriculum for all of these police academies throughout the state. The police departments here are required now to send their, you know, police officers, both new and old, through the Crisis Intervention Team Academy, to learn and to put into practice non-lethal ways of dealing with people with mental illness, even if people are incredibly psychotic, and even if they, you know, in those rare moments where someone who has mental illness may even be seen as being dangerous, that there are actually non-lethal ways to deal with them, and talk, of course, is one of the big ones. Is one of the big methodologies or strategies to use. One of the things that happened recently, and I'm sure we're probably running out of time here.
No, we got plenty of time. Go ahead.
Okay, but I'm going to have to run in a little bit because I have to run somewhere else. But
okay.
I think that, you know, one of the I think one of the results, one of the concrete results of what we had done as a task force. There was a young African-American man whose father had actually called me and said that his son was suicidal, was in an apartment building here in Seaside, had locked himself up and was going to kill himself. The father called me. I came down. The police officers backed away, and they let me work with this young man. And we were able, and even though we were down there for about, I think we were down there for about 8 hours, this young man ended up coming out and going to the hospital.
He had a weapon?
He had a knife, mm-hmm. but he was thinking about killing himself. But see, we had a situation in Marina back in 1992 in which there was a young man who's Filipino, named Filipino Pascua, who was psychotic, who thought that there were things from outer space that were going to come and get him in his house. He lived with his parents. He took a knife, ran into the bathroom, and locked himself in there and was scared to death. The parents called the police. The police came. They wanted to know if he had a weapon. He said, he has a knife, but he's afraid that these things are going to get him. And they said, okay. They took the parents and removed them from the house, would not allow the parents to talk to their son. And then they kicked the door in. And, of course, he thought these things were coming to get him. And actually, the things had blue uniforms. And he ran out of the door screaming, and they shot him 8 times.
The things were coming to get him, in other words.
Right.
You know, the same thing happened in San Jose 2 years ago. I guess 7 people were killed, or I think 8 people were shot by police, 7 of them fatally. I'm not quite sure the exact stats. And several cases were identical to that. I mean, there was a, you know, they cleared the family out of the house, wanted to stay and try to help the, you know, the family member with the mental illness problem.
See, and there was a time, I think, even, you know, with this person happened to be being me that showed up at the scene there, that there was a time when people would have been cordoned off, and neither family members or anyone else would have been allowed to go in and talk to an individual that was in the situation that this young man was in. But the fact that they backed away, and even though I know that there were police officers there who hate me, they backed away, and both myself and the dad. And later we brought in an older brother, and so we spent a lot of time there, and the police officers basically were there for crowd control, and that's the role that they should be playing, you know. And then we were able to get that young man out of there without any harm being done to anything, you know, property or anything. They didn't break in any doors.
When was this?
This was in June of last year.
And we're talking with Mel Mason, who's an activist in Seaside concerned with community control of police and ending police violence and holding police accountable when they are violent toward, well, even guilty people, but innocent people certainly. Do you have an organization that people can contact? Is there a phone contact that they can reach?
Yes. At this point, the organization is kind of headquartered out of our Monterey Peninsula NAACP branch, and I happen to be second vice president and chair of the Legal Redress Committee for the Monterey Peninsula NAACP. They can reach us there at area code 831-394-3727.
That's 831-394-3727. And what do you have any meetings scheduled that are coming up that people should attend if they want to get more closely involved?
Well, we have a meeting that's been tentatively scheduled for the 13th of March, and we're going to be getting information out on that. We don't have a meeting place at this point.
And do you have an email address of any sort?
Right. It's and people can email us at it's all one kind of run together word. It's NAACP MONBR. Mm-hmm. At AOL.com.
Okay, that's NAACP MONBR, all one word, at AOL.com.
Right.
Wow, I mean, I would like to talk to you again. In fact, I'd be happy to continue talking, but it sounds like you got to go.
Yeah, I got to run somewhere, but I'm glad that we had a chance to talk about all this.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can talk more. We've been talking with Mel Mason of Seaside about the specific failures and successes of tribunals in other areas such as Cop Watch in Berkeley and in Portland and Eugene, Oregon, as well as different groups that have tried to engage in a kind of a monitoring of police, tribunals, such as, I guess, your own early efforts with the Black Panthers.
Right.
Did you join them in Seaside, or were you in Berkeley at the time? How did that happen? Or Oakland, I guess, where the Black Panthers formed.
It started.
Well, I should talk to you about that when you have more time.
Okay.
And thanks again, Mel, for giving us a call. And, hey, we're on every week at this time. And mm-hmm. I hope you can call again next week and give us an update on how things are going.
Okay. We'll do.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Robert.
And that was Mel Mason of Seaside, California, former Black Panther Party member, Seaside City Council member, and activist around community control of police. And again, the phone number, if you want to reach the NAACP, whose legal committee I guess he is involved in, is 394-3727. Again, 394-3727, NAACP legal committee in Seaside, California, and the email address is NAACPMONBR. NAACP, M as in Mary, O, N as in Nancy, B as in Brave, R, at AOL.com. And if you miss any of these numbers, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I will get back to you. It's only a voicemail, but I do return my calls regularly, and I check that message to see what's message machine to see what's cooking. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Stay with us. Welcome again to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We got about 2.5 hours of showtime ahead of us, and there is an election day coming up in 2 days. We're going to be hopefully talking about that down the line. But before we do, I had a very interesting conversation yesterday with David Bush, as he now prefers to be known, to distinguish him from the evil Bush. He wants to be the good Bush. So this is David Bush, and every time you hear David Bush, think David Bush. He actually spells his name B-U-S-C-H. David Bush is an activist in Santa Monica, who has been involved in the cutting edge of basic homeless civil rights. That is, the right of a homeless person to get the same kind of services that anyone else gets in public accommodations and not be discriminated against because of his appearance or her appearance. And David has several lawsuits going because of such discrimination, and he is also a very eloquent speaker on them. We're going to just dive right into his report about Santa Monica and what's been happening down there. It's a very long report, so what we're going to do is we're going to split this up. I think we'll play some of this today and some of this in subsequent shows, but well worth listening to. You can also call in during this report, and I can talk to you off air at 427-3772, 427-3772. There'll also be an opportunity for a discussion period. I'll try to make a break within the next 15 minutes. You can talk about anything you've heard from Santa Monica. Santa Monica is a community down in Southern California, close to Los Angeles on the coast. Has some similarities with Santa Cruz. It's about twice the size or more. But it is also, it has people who call themselves Green Party members who've made it onto the city council, but then who do nothing about the Green Party planks around civil rights for the homeless or do the opposite. It has the same kind of hypocrisy where it claims to be very liberal and very caring, but actually is more concerned with raking in the tourist bucks and worrying about imaginary magnet effects if it were to deal with the real issue of its poor and homeless people in its own city. Pushing them out of sight, pushing them to other venues, putting up a sign, essentially homeless, unwelcome in Santa Monica. And we're going to hear some of that discussion, although some of the incidents you hear about didn't actually happen in Santa Monica, but in nearby Venice. It's quite an eye-opener, and it's a very well-told story. So listen on. It's March 2nd, about 15 after 9. We're continuing a conversation with David Bush. David, you're talking about your recent arrest at a sports bar in where?
Yeah, Venice Beach, California. I was just arrested again about 2 months ago in, of all places, Venice Beach, California boardwalk, for having the nerve to walk into a sports bar full of a bunch of beer-slopping, cut-off-wearing, brain-dead sports fanatic jockstraps, and while they were slurping up their beer and watch the game, want to just simply sit down and have a cup of coffee. I thought that that'd be kind of an innocuous activity, but I was arrested for it.
And you were the waitress, as you said, pointed to, or I guess the owner, whoever she was, the worker there said, pointed the sign, we reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. You pointed out, if you've seen a Confederate flag on the wall, you'll know that that has about as much legal force as a Confederate flag.
I'll tell you the story. I walked into just a sports bar to order a cup of coffee. It was a rainy day. I'm homeless. I was waiting for a peace march to begin, and I got there about two hours early. And so it was raining. I walked into this sports bar to order a cup of coffee. And as I walked in the door, the manager of this German beer hall themed sports bar, who was a large, heavy set, Germanish looking woman. I felt like I was there because she, without even saying hello or anything, just pointed her finger at me like I was some kind of 6-year-old in need of reproving, and started wagging her finger and said to me, uh-uh. Well, you know, usually when you go into a restaurant, you're not greeted by a hostess who says to you, uh-uh. You know, they ask you where you want to sit. So I was a little surprised, and so I said to her, uh-uh, what do you mean, uh-uh? And she pointed next to this sign prominently hung over the bar, which said, we reserve the right to refuse service to anybody, in bold, disgusting red letters. And she said, you know what that sign says? And I said to her, yes, I know what that sign says. I know it really well. I said, have you ever walked into a bar, though, and seen a Confederate flag hanging over the bar? And I said, you know, the fact is that that sign has about as much legal validity and legal precedent as a Confederate flag. Neither one of them have any basis in law anymore, and are really nothing more than a symbol of the own hate. And to be honest with you, I don't want any trouble here. I just want a cup of coffee. But because I am homeless and I get arrested like this all the time, for the last 3 years I've found myself, in order just to protect myself from lies, having to carry a tape recorder with me everywhere I go. And 90% of the time, if I walk into a place where I've never been before, I turn it on. And as you can see, and I held out my hand, I have in my hand my tape recorder, which I encourage every homeless person to carry if you want to protect yourself as a human being in this country. That's how bad it's gotten. And as you can see, I said to this woman, manager, that my tape is running. And look, I don't want a problem. I'm a member of the homeless newspaper of LA. I'm a community activist. But I just want a cup of coffee.
What's the name of this bar, by the way?
You know, it's something like the Winter Garden. It's some German beer... It's the only German beer hall-themed sports bar on the Venice Beach Boardwalk in Venice, California. It's two blocks north of Rose Street. You can't miss it.
Do they have a little sort of round of the Horst Wessel lead after you were... That's a Nazi song from the old days. Go ahead.
Oh, I could tell you about the friendly bar patron come bouncer who stood next to her, and when I pointed out the tape recorder, looked at me and said, "I had to kick your ass. You know, I could kill you." But that's another story. How the incident escalated from that.
What happened? Give us more. This sounds pretty exciting.
Well, the brief and the short of it is I called the police and told them I was receiving death threats, and they came out and arrested me.
Ah, of course.
For trespassing.
And of course, you weren't being served coffee in the meantime.
No.
Did you leave the bar?
But I am being served by the Lawyers Guild, mm-hmm. who's handling the lawsuit.
Back to the bar to check them. Maybe we should stop there for coffee this morning.
No, at the advice of my lawyer, I'm seeking coffee elsewhere.
I see. Now, did you actually leave when the bouncer gave you the death threat, or did you hang? Did you sort of sit down at a bar? What did you do?
Well, I kind of looked at him. I said, "Haven't you had a few too many? I mean, look, man, I'm tape recording this, as you saw.
Right.
You just gave me a death threat on tape, and you know you're bigger than me. You weigh more than me. But I'm not trying to be your enemy. I'm not trying to escalate nothing here."
And he said.
He said, "I ought to kill you. I ought to kick your ass. I don't care if you're taping this. I ought to kill you."
And what was the reaction of the surrounding patrons?
Well, you'd think that they would be shocked, but I think the shocking thing is people these days can sit around while a homeless person is receiving death threats from a drunk and try to pretend that they can continue to eat their burger.
Now, was this guy drunk, or was he just simply the bouncer?
You know... He certainly was acting like he was drunk. He had a beer in front of him. I didn't smell anything on him. He didn't really act extremely intoxicated, but I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. The police let him go with no breathalyzer test.
How many police came?
Seven.
And what was the time between your call and the police response?
Well, it took three calls. They hung up on me twice and said basically the death threats aren't an emergency. But the third time they did finally come out, it took about 15 minutes, and the guy had physically assaulted me by that time.
What had he done?
He, when he saw me going to the phone, jumped up.
First time or the second time or the third time you called?
Second time. When he saw me go to the phone, he started screaming at me, "I'm going to kill you." And I said, "Look, buddy, I'm going to make a phone call, and I want you to leave me alone." I picked up the phone. He started listening to who I was talking to, and when he realized it was the police, he said, "Get out of here," and started using profanity at me. And as I was telling to the police that I'm receiving death threats, I'd like some police assistance, they hung up on me. And even though I'm sure they could hear the death threats in the background. And I'm not exaggerating. These were serious threats. I was in fear of my life. And
so what happened? Did you leave the bar to make a call to somewhere else, or did you make the phone call?
No, I picked up the phone again, and I figured that if I wanted to avoid violence, the best way was to get the police out there. And
not necessarily the best approach, but who knows?
My thinking was clouded.
Yeah.
I hadn't had my coffee.
You haven't had enough drinking.
The second time I got on the phone, he grabbed the phone out of my hand, shoved me against the wall, and gave me physical gestures and a look that said, "Okay, buddy, we're gonna tussle here, right here and right now." And I said to him, "Look, man, back off." And at that point, the manager realized she was about to have a brawl in the bar, and she told the guy, "Get out." And she could see me on the phone calling the police. She told her bouncer to leave.
And you know it was her bouncer? How did you know it was her bouncer?
By their actions and gestures. And
so you got her to fire her, order her own employee off the premises?
Well, I think she realized she was getting into deep doo-doo. Mm-hmm. And that I had a tape and I had evidence and this guy was being a lunatic. But I think she was just basically trying to, she realized she had to go into cover-up mode, uh-huh. Get her bouncer out of the bar before the police showed up.
And what, did she say anything to you?
No.
So you called the police a third time?
Called the police a third time.
Did you get a different officer each time? Or?
No, I screamed at him the third time, are you guys coming? This is the third time I've had to call you, I've been assaulted, and you are recording this, aren't you? This is a 911 call being recorded, because you know what, I'm gonna sue. So
apparently the legal threat, unlike some people's views, had an effective impact at this point.
Yeah, words to that effect. I can't say those were my exact words. I was pretty shook up.
Then you sat down and waited for your coffee.
I stood by the phone until I saw the police out front pull up in their unit through the window.
How many police? I mean, how many cars?
Two cars.
Seven police officers?
Seven police officers.
That's a lot of police officers for two cars.
I think two of them walked up on bicycles or something like that.
Okay. And then what happened?
I went outside because the bouncer who had attacked me had run out the door, and I ran outside, and it was like within minutes that the police pulled up, and I ran out. At that point, I thought, okay, it's safe to go outside. I wasn't sure. When the guy went outside, I thought he might be lurking out there for me and was going to attack me once I went outside. So when the police pulled up, I thought, okay, I can go out there now. And it was within minutes. So I went out there and I attempted to tell the police, look, I'm the person that made the call. The guy who attacked me just ran down the street that way. And can we see him? And I tried to direct their attention to helping me spot this guy who attacked me and committed assault and battery on me. And they looked at me and insisted that I stand where I was, that I shut up, that they were going into the bar to talk to the manager. And when they came out, they said, you're not going back in the bar. And I was like floored by that. They didn't give it, they totally brushed aside the fact that I called them because I was being assaulted while I was on the phone with them.
Right.
And at that point I realized that as far as protecting a homeless person's life, these cops were useless.
Kind of slow on the uptake, aren't you there, David? This is a month ago?
Robert, I'm 46 years old. I spent half my life believing that America was a place that was about law and order.
Orange County propaganda. You've been watching too much television, obviously.
Well, you go through a big change when you become homeless.
So the police officer told you not to go into the bar, and your response was?
My thought was, these people are useless as far as protecting my life or my rights. The guy has gotten away. The issue is now whether or not a homeless person has a right to order a cup of coffee. And I'm going to protect that right, and I'll get some help to track down this guy who's threatening me later. My issue became immediately, is this just going to be another case of the cops enforcing property rights for people, letting homeless people get death threats?
We don't want none of you coloreds in our bars. You know, there are bars for you people. You go downtown, there are homeless service centers. You go down there. You don't need to go in no.
You sound like one of the officers that was trying to talk to me with their propaganda.
There's nothing against you niggers, as long as you stay in your right place.
Yeah. The H word. So I said to the sergeant, I said, look, am I under arrest by you guys? And he said, no. And I said, in that case, you're blocking my path. Get out of my way. I'm going back into that restaurant and have my cup of coffee. And he said, well, if you go in there, we're going to arrest you. I said, look, do what you're going to do, but I'm not under arrest. Get out of my way.
What did they do then?
They followed me in. They had a conference with the manager. They came back and told me that I was being placed under arrest.
Citizen's arrest?
For trespass. And I asked them, I said, is it citizen's arrest? And they said, yes. And I said, well, in that case, I demand that you accept my citizen's arrest of the store manager for false arrest.
Or and assault.
The bouncer.
Yeah. At that point, I just said false arrest of the store manager for my false arrest. And the sergeant there argued with me back and forth about six times whether or not he was going to accept my arrest. And when I pointed out several sections of the law and the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution.
What sections of the law did you point out?
One of the 26 subsections of the Trespass Code 602.1, I was attempting to ascertain under what subsection of the California Penal Code trespass statute I was being charged with, so that I might try to engage this sergeant of the LAPD in his recollection of that statute.
Useful knowledge for a homeless person to have, the trespass code.
Yeah. You don't have to remember all 26 sections. It starts out with trespass for the purpose of stealing timber.
602.1A.
And as a matter of fact, on my official arrest record, what I was officially arrested for was stealing timber.
I wish
the sergeant would have at least cracked his code book before he arrested me.
He eventually told you you were being charged with stealing timber, or actually what, refusing to leave a place of business when asked, or some such. But he cited the wrong code section.
And this is about the sixth time I've been arrested by an LAPD officer on these kind of scenarios. I considered it progress when he agreed that he would accept my arrest, even though I was going into custody, I was being handcuffed and being hauled to the police station, that at least he would, for the record, cite and release the store manager for my counter arrest.
Did you ask to be cite and released?
Yes, I did.
Why did he refuse?
He said it was an imminent threat to the sports bar. I guess coffee is a deadly weapon.
Yeah, well. You might go and urinate in the back, you know, somewhere, like one of their bathrooms.
Terrorist one hole is.
It might be deadly to human rights and justices.
Wow. So, did you mention to him the UNRRA Civil Rights Act at any point? The requirement of public accommodations not to discriminate against specific classes of people?
I think I did mention the UNRRA Act.
And what was his response?
I mentioned it to one of the sergeants, and her response was, "I'm a robot. I do what my sergeant tells me to do. I hear no evil, speak no evil, and do no evil. I just do what I'm told." Sieg Heil.
Well, it was a German sports bar, after all.
Yeah.
So you are. Where is this case currently standing? Are you? This is a misdemeanor trespass.
This is during the Olympics. I mean, the Germans were like maybe.
This was last June. Olympic fever hadn't really hit. 911 hadn't even hit.
And so this.
Excuse me. This was
3 weeks ago.
3 weeks ago. It was post September 11th, but it was prior to the Olympics.
We're in just pre-Olympic hype. Yeah, the Germans kicked ass.
And you're listening to a tape made actually yesterday in Santa Monica, California, with activist David Bush. The other voice you hear is that of video journalist Becky Johnson, who was down there attending an LA conference on a settlement conference about the injuries she had suffered from the LAPD at the Democratic National Convention in 2000, and she was also present for this conversation with activist David Bush, or Bush, as I call him, as he now calls himself, talking about the trials and tribulations of a homeless person trying to get a cup of coffee in a seaside sports bar in Venice, which is a city just south of Santa Monica, Venice Beach. I think that's the same Venice. Let's hear a little bit more of this discussion. And again, this is only a number of cases that has been, all of which, I think, great vis are worth our listening to. Having a little trouble with this tape here, but...
So it's about 9:30. We're talking with David Bush, continuing interview on the issue of the trespass situation down at Venice Beach 3 weeks ago. So where's your case now? You were arrested. You were handcuffed. You were taken down to headquarters. How long were you held there?
28 hours before I was arraigned the next day and released. Case was declined to prosecute by discretion of the city attorney, and I have retained a civil rights lawyer who's agreed that I have a case and is willing to help me file it. And we have a 90-minute micro cassette recording of the entire incident.
Sell the rights to CNN, or does Bathrop Spears Broadsides get the first crack at the
Bathrop Spears Broadside?
That's the name of my radio show, yeah.
Gets exclusive.
Ooh!
All right, Tremble. So we're, that's the first of how many arrests in the last...
As soon as I get it out of police evidence. It's being safely held in police evidence.
Wait a minute, the case was dismissed. How can it be held in police evidence?
It's held in the property department until I go down and remove it. And
Have you tried to do that?
Not yet. I plan to go down there in a week or two. It depends on whether my lawyer wants to preserve some kind of chain of custody by taking it up themselves.
I see. So you're not afraid the police are going to damage or otherwise alter this tape?
I am afraid. That's why I'm waiting for my lawyer to go down there and remove it rather than me.
I see. So this arrest followed a prior arrest involving another civil rights issue. Which was?
The most immediately prior to that was arrested for sitting on the sidewalk in Santa Monica and eating a muffin.
The muffin arrest, which is also the subject of a civil lawsuit?
Correct.
Now what about the previous to that? Let's go back one more step.
Arrested at the Getty Museum in Mulholland Pass for having the nerve to walk into the Getty Museum being homeless with a sign over my neck with the words unhoused on it.
And that's going to be played at the next edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. We're going to break this up a bit, maybe keep a little tension, keep you enthusiasts tuned in. We do a show twice a week here on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3, we being me, myself, and I here in the studio, and sometimes with an alternate host or a guest, but this time the guests are on tape or on the phone line. But again, you've been listening to David Bush, or Boosh, I've got to keep remembering, in Santa Monica, California. I also went through Santa Barbara, so it kind of muddles my memory, talking about his current legal cases against the LAPD and the various city bureaucrats for civil rights violations of people the right to use public have a cup of coffee, which has been done here in Santa Cruz as well, by the way. You put them in a position of not just being a second-class citizen, but a situation of perpetual fear, perpetually having to worry about whether they can have the same kind of basic, decent treatment that the rest of us who aren't homeless would normally expect walking into a restaurant. Of course, it doesn't include African Americans in Denny's and things like that, but set that aside. There have been a number of lawsuits about that issue in the last decade. So, Free Radio Santa Cruz is what you're tuned to, 96.3 FM, and we have a call-in number in case you have some thoughts about what you've heard, 427-3772, or perhaps you've had a problem here in Santa Cruz you'd like to talk about on the air in terms of discrimination. I'd love to hear it. If you want to talk about it off-air, you can give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, or come to our HUFF meeting on Wednesday, 8:30 in the morning at Baker's Square Restaurant at 1107 Ocean Street. That's one of those options. It looks like we got a caller calling in.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert. Steve, how
Ah, notorious Huffster, eh?
Yeah.
You're a Huff UCSC, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. And I just want to remind everybody, we have our meetings Wednesday evenings, 6 p.m. on the second story of the Student Center.
Hmm. So what's happening on campus? You know, your liberal bastion is planning to set up a peace city, 1,000 students strong, I understand, with rights for homeless people being a very important thing, rent control, a close end the bombing of Afghanistan. And tell me more about that imaginary project.
Well, actually, April 15th, we're thinking as a good day to maybe get some students together downtown and do a protest. I'm looking at my calendar right now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that should be April 13th, come to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
But when did you say the armory is closing?
I believe it's April 15th, but again, I got this from Chris Storms, the ISSP worker at the Homeless Services Center, and it may be that they may be able to extend it to the 30th, or it may close as soon as the 1st, but 15th, I think, was what his impression was when I talked to him last week.
Uh-huh. Well, we definitely want to get students down there, downtown, to show people that this is something that, you know, is just because it's unseen, these kinds of effects, doesn't mean that it's not going on.
What are the big issues on campus these days? I know that the there was there's a primary campaign, of course, which is going to be concluding on Tuesday, day after tomorrow. I know that you you and I have spoken with Michael Schmidt, who's done some tabling on campus. But what about it's Wormhout, Premack versus Schmidt? What's your sense on the student sense of all this?
You know, I really don't know. You mean in terms of who they want to win?
Who won, and then what are the big issues that have, other than, I don't know, getting their papers in?
And partying.
partying.
You know, I really couldn't tell you the student climate as, you know, with regard to the candidates. I've spoken with a couple people, actually, though, who have said that they like what Marty Wormhout was talking about, but when I let them know how she feels about the sleeping ban, they change their minds rather quickly.
Wow, but can you change enough minds in the next 48 hours? That's the question, huh?
Right. Well, I don't think I can change anybody's mind necessarily, but who do you see maybe getting elected here?
You know, I'm really at a loss. I don't really know. I mean, it looks like Schmidt, according to today's paper or Friday's paper, they had a series of articles on, I just picked them up when I got back, about who's spending how much. And according to this, Marty Wormhout spent about $8,000 in the last period, a total of $60,000 so far in the campaign. I'm rounding it off. Getting contributions from union reps, County Building Inspector James Heaney, Realtor Jerry Ganges, developer Shirley Einhorn. Schmidt, who's the former head of the Santa Cruz Area Chamber of Commerce, according to this Santa Cruz Sentinel story from yesterday, raised only $707 compared with the about $8,000 that Wormhout raised during this last period, and a total of about $18,000 compared with her total of $60,000. Again, funds were spent on newspaper ads, reservation of a motel room for a victory celebration. He's a little optimistic. And Mack, who's currently a city council member and an incumbent on the city council in Santa Cruz, spent $3,500, again, compared with $700 for Schmidt and $8,000 for Wormhout. Total, $37,000, again, total, compared with Schmidt's total of $18,000, Wormhout's total of $60,000. Includes contributions from construction manager Michael McClellan, real estate appraiser David Plumley, who's also a somewhat, you might say, conservative chocolate and flower person downtown who sells at the corner of Cedar and Cathcart Streets. And he's been held to be one of the people who's responsible for pressuring stuff around the farmer's market and being a downtown association. But in all candor, Premack, who he supports, Premack's funds were spent on newspaper ads, yard signs, Kinko's campaign literature, mailings, television ads, and campaign calls. So that's what the Sentinel tells us in terms of the amount of money spent. Now, Schmidt tells us, and I'm going to actually call him up soon and see if I can reach him by phone, though he may be still attending the funeral services around his mother, who died recently. He has gone to about He knocked on 10,000 doors and talked to, I think, 3,500 people in the last 6 or 8 months, and a kind of a what's called shoe leather campaign. So it's hard to tell what people are going to, you know, do in this primary. And this is a primary where you can really vote your conscience, because it's most likely that no one's going to win a majority. It's, you know, there are three candidates running, and they'll be obviously, but no one's necessarily going to get 51%.
Right. Well, you know, when I spoke with Premack and face to face, he said a couple things that really interested me. He said, first of all, that homeless people's rights shouldn't be spoken up for until they've earned the respect of the community, mm-hmm. and earned the acceptance of the community.